This is The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And in studio with me today is Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist. And we're going to have a conversation about insects. It's the summer. It's hot. I'm sure populations are just going off with gangbusters as both beneficial and not so beneficial insects are trying to reproduce and take over the world as it
were. I'm sure as how many gardeners feel.
My gardening world before the summer and fall end. And one of the first things that I did want to talk about, because I haven't seen any yet, I've been quite happy about this, grasshoppers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this was overall has been a season of extremes. We had one of the warmest late winter, January, February's on record, I believe, for Utah, many places in Utah. So things were just speeding along. You know, we were concerned that insects were going to be out so early and we were going to have a much longer season. And then things turned cool in April, and then May in particular was a very wet month. And that kind of all, then it seems like insects kind of hid away and then it seemed like they were really slowed down, and it was, you know, and then it was more issues with fungal diseases and things like that from all the moisture. And then June came in with a furnace, I guess you want to call it, or a blowtorch. And it's just been so hot now, but I think it was the hottest June on record for at least for northern Utah. And now things with terms of insects have just, you know, sped along again. So it's been this interesting season of quick start, put on the brakes for a bit, and now we're back into full throttle. So definitely grasshoppers are a concern. We've seen nymphs out for quite a while already. I've had reports from some places like in Millard County where grasshopper and Morven crickets can be quite high numbers there that they are this year and having some real problems with them in the crops and the gardens there in that area. So here in northern Utah or other places where our radio signals reach, when you're talking about a home garden or a smaller scale, there are baits that can be purchased and applied, but they really are most effective when you get them when they're still the small nymphs, because what they're attracted to eat the bait has a food attractant in it, and then they ingest either an insecticide or there's a natural biological control called Nosema, which is a protozoan that kills grasshoppers, and they ingest that and it kills them. So either way, the baits can be very effective, but you've got to start using them when the nymphs are small.
So when you say small, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about something that's, you know, a half inch kind of or less, depending on the species of grasshopper. So once we start getting up into 3/4 inch, inch, and larger, and some species you certainly get, you know, multiple inches.
So at that point, there's not a whole lot you can do other than hand picking them?
It's just that you're kind of behind the curve by that point, and so it's hard to have the impact. The other issue for people that have small land holdings, so home gardeners, that kind of thing, if you're not working together with your neighborhood, with your community, and doing this on a broader scale, it can have pretty little impact. If you put out bait just around, you know, your garden or on the edge around the edges of your property where you can see the grasshoppers moving in from the uncultivated land outside, It's just a drop in the bucket kind of effect, and so that makes it tough. So what I have seen and personally experienced myself with garden grasshopper control in the garden is don't overlook the real value of the floating row covers, because covering up the plants and keeping the grasshoppers off that way can make a really big difference. And there are many of our garden crops do need pollinators. So if you're growing squash or peppers, they need to have bees need to have access to the plants. And so that can make it tough. But a lot of the pollination does take place in the morning, soon as it just first starts to warm up, which right now is, it never cools down. So it's immediately at sunrise. But if it's a cooler day, then, you know, as soon as the temperatures start to rise, the bees come out. And so having the row covers off for 2-3 hours in the morning and then putting them on when the grasshoppers are most active and more in the afternoon hours. And so you can still use the row covers if you have the time and are there to kind of micromanage them a bit. But I've seen that work be a very effective approach for the home garden, and you know, versus trying to spray everything with an insecticide and then having to deal with having those residues on your plants and when you can pick and you know, then what negative impacts that might be causing on pollinators and beneficial insects. So try to think about outside the box a little.
And the biological control agent can be really expensive.
It can be.
So that doesn't make any sense to try to use it if, A, it's not going to do any good. But when you do use it, at the right time, describe what it does to the grasshopper.
Yeah, so Nosema is it's a protozoan, which is a little tiny, well, in the resting stage, it's a spore. And when it's ingested by a host, that is something that it's adapted to infect, grasshoppers in this case, it comes alive, so to speak, comes out of its resting stage. And it actually before it kills the grasshopper, it alters its behavior. So what it does is makes the grasshoppers want to climb up high. And so they they stop feeding. You know, they're not feed, or first it's, you know, slow down and feeding, then eventually they stop feeding.
So we're looking at a day
or
two?
They're sick. So it can take a couple days, depending on the species of grasshopper, its age. So the older it is, the more resilient and more tolerant it is of the protozoan. When it's younger, it's very susceptible. So I would say for a young grasshopper, it'll definitely be within a day. For older grasshoppers, it may take several days. And it makes them want to climb up high. They don't know why. It just alters their behavior. And then they die at that point when they're sitting on the top of a plant. And then after a week or so, as the protozoan develops inside us by basically, reproducing inside the body and replicating, and then the grasshopper will, the exoskeleton, the shell, will kind of like crack open, and then these spores of the protozoan will rain down on the plant around it and adjacent plants. And so then as other grasshoppers then eat that plant and ingest the spore, they do the same thing. So it's a nice self-replicating system. So it can work really well if, one, you get it on early, at the timing when the nymphs when the nymphs are really small. And number two, you have this ability to treat enough of an area that you're making an impact on the population. If you're just putting down a really small area and you kill a few grasshoppers, but there's just waves of additional ones coming in, you're not going to see that benefit.
And how far do grasshoppers move?
So, it will depend on the species. We talk about grasshoppers as if there's just one kind, and they're actually a very diverse group of insects.
Because I see brown ones. I see dark brown. I see green. I see the ones that make sounds when they flap their wings and when I get close and they take off.
And they're not all pests either. There are some species. I mean, they all feed on plants. They're all herbivores. There's no predaceous grasshoppers. But some of them are not. You know, they eat so little, or the things they eat aren't really a problem for humans in terms of our ability to garden and grow crops. So it's only a handful of species that are really our problem ones. And they can move, you know, quarter mile, a half mile with hopping, you know, once they're into the adult stage. We don't have the migratory locusts. Well, they call them locusts, but they're grasshoppers, like they do in like Saharan, kinds of environments where they can fly, you know, many, many, many miles on wind current, on winds, and move great distances and big hordes. We don't have those species here, thank goodness, in North America. At one time in the way distant past. So fortunately, we, you know, the species we have here, they're moving, you know, quarter mile, half mile kinds of distances. So it's not tremendous, but the problem comes when there's just very many of them. And
you can lay a whole barrier of that bait, and they just keep coming and they keep coming.
So it just depends on all those factors. You know, the bait can be effective under the certain circumstances and if used at the right time. But if you have too many grasshoppers, not treating a large enough area, then it's not going to work as well.
Do they tend to remain stationary in a certain locale once they get large enough? Or do they still keep moving?
No, they keep moving because the adults they're the reproductive stage, and they only generally, most of our problem species, I'm not a grasshopper expert, so I hate to say this with certainty, they mostly have a single generation. a year, and the adults need to lay their eggs. The female needs to lay her eggs back out on undisturbed land. So they're not going to lay their eggs in your cultivated garden, or even in your lawn for the most part. Or I have seen grasshoppers hatch from is sand that I had between flagstones and a patio. So they seem to like that kind of dry, kind of packed soil, but not disturbed. And so they're going to go back out to the rangeland, to the foothills, you know, to empty lots where there's just maybe some like weeds growing, but there's still a lot of packed soil there. That's the kind of places they're going to lay their eggs. And so they adults need to move back out to those kinds of sites to lay the eggs.
Mm. Well, let's hope that the populations stay lower. We'll see what happens as the summer continues to move along.
There's definitely going to be some hot spots. There always are. We have, especially when we have drought kinds of conditions, which we're now experiencing this summer. Those are ideal conditions to promote grasshoppers.
So what is it looking like in Oak City? Because that's usually one of the towns where in Miller County that...
Yeah, so I haven't heard specifically about Oak City, but I have had reports from Millard County that there's some real problem areas. So so I should mention that the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food, they do have some funds to help support landowners in terms of grasshopper Mormon cricket control. So if you are experiencing, you know, what you feel is, you know, enough problem levels that you'd like to get some support, they have a cost share program. So we're probably not talking about small home gardens for the most part. We're talking about people that have some crops or a little bit, you know, more acreage. And so the best way to find out about that is either to contact the Utah Department of Ag and Food directly or to contact your local USU County Extension agent for your county, because they work together with the Extension Service and they'll know who to contact, how to find out about this cost sharing program. And it's generally I think it's for both bait, so the carbaryl type of bait, but also maybe some spraying applications as well, you know, insecticide spraying applications.
So the Mormon cricket, which is, I think, actually a katydid?
Yes.
Where is it? What's its distribution?
So it tends to be mostly in western Utah, and then also in Nevada and places in Idaho, Montana, where it occurs. But there can be some populations in other little spots. We've even seen some. It was Malad City area. Mm-hmm. I remember a few years back that there was kind of a little hot spot of Mormon crickets. So they're mostly western, you know, desert, rangeland kinds of sites where they occur. And their populations can be spotty. They can be really hot, like in Box Elder County, had some real problems with them for a while, and then in Tooele area. And then, you know, right now it seems to be Millard County. So they kind of have ups and downs over time.
I've never seen one before until I was going over the short divide between Clarkston and Plymouth, and I could see them marching across the roads. Of course, I had to get out and take a look at them, and I haven't seen them since. Of course, I don't travel that way very often at all. But
I don't think they're a frequent occurrence in that area, but when they do occur, they can be quite dramatic. Did they make the roads slick with their dead bodies? That's always the comment you hear.
I don't think
say.
I moved along any further. I was going up to our transmitter site and had just seen them in this one section, and there weren't a ton of them yet, or maybe there had been, and I just didn't see it at that time. But
and so interesting, Mormon crickets actually have different phases. So what you saw was the migratory phase, and so they're very dark in color; they're almost black. Mm-hmm. But they do have a non-migratory phase. So when their populations aren't that high, and they're just kind of hanging out, doing their thing, you know, feeding like they normally do, they're more of a lighter brown color, and they're not in that dispersal kind of mode where you see them marching across roads and fields.
So what are they doing?
And they're just, and they eat plants, and so they're hanging out doing their thing.
But as they march.
Oh, what are they doing that for? Well, it's a dispersal mechanism. So when populations reach, it has to do with crowding, lack of food. So if they're too many and they're eating up the food, you know, the food in an area, they develop this migratory phase. And so that's what sends them off to move. And they don't fly. So the only way they can get somewhere is by walking.
Well, you'd think they disperse in opposite directions from each other instead of all moving together.
I guess they feel their strength in numbers, like the wildebeest herds or something, you know, when the lions attack, that they're not going to get them all, so they'll just pick off a few.
Well, you're listening to the Zesty Garden. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. She's in studio with me today, and another topic we need to make sure we cover is coddling moth.
Yes.
It seems like we're always covering coddling moth, but it's a major pest.
It's, I mean, when I talk with my colleague, Marion Murray, who, if you do get the IPM advisories, those newsletters we talk about a lot, she's the one who's responsible for those. And, you know, what's the question that you get the most, Marion? And she says, it's, when is it time to spray for coddling moth? And she said, when, what's the question you get the most, Diane? I said, when is it time to spray for coddling moth? So,
and my answer would be, get the PDF and then you won't have to call and, or talk to me.
So. That's right. And that's, well, and that's exactly why what instigated the advisories is to really was to help the county extension agents, because if we're getting those questions here in Logan, you know how many times they're getting it out there in the around the state, and was to try to help them, to give them some just the answers they need of what is the timing for my area. And so it does vary with temperature. We've talked about that because it's how fast the insects develop. And coddling moth has, we used to say it has two primary generations in Utah, in northern Utah. I think this year we're going to say it's going to have three generations in many areas. Hopefully Cache County won't get too much of that last generation. But with our hot summer we're having, that means that the insect develops faster. And so we're probably going to have a third generation in many areas. And so right now we're into the second generation. And what we saw this year was the first generation was quite low, quite small in number.
Which, I didn't see
which
much
was good.
At all in my fruit trees, which is really good because I hadn't sprayed. And I'm usually waiting until I see a little bit of damage first anyway. So that's good for me.
And so what caused those low numbers? We're not, you know, sure, we can speculate, as we always do. It may have been that really wet May. It was just the time when they were starting to come out. We had a lot of cool weather and a lot of wet weather. And coddling moth, most moths fly right at dusk, just before and just after dusk. That's their key time to be active. And coddling moth is like that. And so it could have been just those dusk time temperatures were too cool. It was raining or it was very heavy dew, very wet, and it wasn't conducive to their activity. And so we didn't see a very large first generation for the most part. There may be areas out there that there's an exception to that, but just kind of all across northern Utah where we do our trapping and sampling, we didn't see very many in that first generation. But now Marion tells me that she's seen some pretty big numbers starting to show up for second generation flight. So that tells me that the ones that did survive first generation did well. And so now we're seeing a much larger second generation. So it's very important if you want to keep the coddling moth larvae, these are the little caterpillars, or people call them worms, that get into your apple and pear. If you want to keep them out, you need to put something on the fruit before they get in. And the most common way that's been done was with insecticides. And this is a product that will kill the insect before it has a chance to get in. And with our integrated pest management approach, we time that as precisely as possible for when those eggs start to hatch, and then protect the fruit at that time so we don't have to put on extra sprays. But there are some other ways you can do that. And the primary other one is with a physical means, a barrier, and that is by covering the fruit with some kind of a fruit bag. And the preferred method of bagging fruit, I believe, that we found by exploring some different options is using something as simple as a nylon stocking, you know, those footsie little short footsie ones that you can buy in bulk, and use that to cover the fruit. They're pretty cheap. And it keeps the eggs from being laid on the fruit, and then thus the caterpillar from being able to get into the fruit.
And they don't wear stockings, so there's just no use for them at all.
They don't have any use for them. But you can buy specialized coddling moth bags if you want. They just cost more.
And it seems like that might be quite a bit of work, but I guess it depends on how valuable the fruit is to you. So.
Right. And when I talk with home gardeners and they say, oh, but I have hundreds of fruit on my apple tree, and I say, well, currently, do you spray? Well, usually no, or I'm too late, or whatever doesn't work. Well, if you bought 50 of these footsie stockings and you could use them for, I presume, many years and covered 50 fruit, would you be happy with 50 beautiful, big, clean apples? Oh, yes, I would. Well, so.
You wouldn't have to do anything
right.
The rest of the year.
So you're not going to cover the hundreds and hundreds of fruit on the tree. You're going to cover maybe 50 or 100 or whatever, you know, it is that is your goal.
And come to think of it, if you've got like a honey gold or some kind of a yellow apple that tends to get sunburned in this kind of heat, That would help.
It does.
Down on some of that burning on that side of the fruit.
And one of the questions we get is, well, will my fruit color up if you're like one, if you have a red apple? But what you just said is true about protecting from sunburn. And so the answer is yes. You would be amazed how quickly fruit will color up. So you keep those bags on until we're about September 15th when we're done with codling moth, when codling moth is finished for the season. And then you pull those bags off, and within just a short amount of time, the fruit will color up, redden up if it's a red apple.
Does it tend to fall off, or does it stick on pretty well?
So I generally suggest using some kind of a twist tie or something to attach it to the twig, you know, part. So I should back up a little bit. To use the most effectively use the bags is you should thin your fruit out. So fruit comes in clusters.
Yes.
You've probably seen how apples grow in a cluster. And usually there's one apple in there that's the biggest. We call that the king bloom or the king fruit. So thin off, just hand thin off the other smaller ones, keeping the king fruit. Put your bag over that. Use a twist tie or some other device to keep it onto the twig, and it should be good. And you know, the apple's going to start off small. You would put these on when the fruit are about half to 3/4 inch diameter. So don't do it when they're too small, or they'll just fall off because of the physical, you know, handling of it. And then, of course, the fruit's going to grow, and it's going to fill that bag on the inside. But it should hold up.
My Gale Gala tends to just get a ton of fruit every year. But my Honeycrisp, which is the prized apple at our home, that's the one I'm thinking about. Maybe I should start
to try that.
Doing this one a little bit more with that one, because that's the one we want to make sure we can eat at the end of the year.
And I know people hate to thin off fruit, but really you'll be much happier with the size of the fruit, the larger fruit that you leave per cluster, and just have one per cluster rather than having 3-4 small fruit.
It's the Zesty Garden. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. She's in studio with me today, and I wanted to make sure I mentioned the address of where people can sign up for the IPM advisories. So you can go to the Utah Public Radio page, upr.org, and click the drop-down menu for programs, and then go to Zesty Garden, and we have a sign-up there. If you can remember this address, it's utahpests.usu.edu/IPM, which stands for Integrated Pest Management.
Right.
And there's a lot of great other information that's there as well. So
there is.
It's very helpful. Next topic, we can look at mites. I wanted to ask about mites. Mm-hmm. My dad says that every year his Caroline raspberries start getting this mottled look on the older leaves.
At the lower down.
Is that mite damage?
It certainly could be. It's not so much what I call mottled as kind of what I call a russeting.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so that's classic spider mite feeding on raspberries. And many, many plants have a similar, but raspberry leaves seem to be particularly sensitive. So the mite has kind of a stylet-like piercing mouth part, and so when it breaks the exterior of the plant, of the leaf surface to feed, it makes all these little tiny stipules, but those kind of turn into this russeting effect, and raspberry leaves are sensitive to this feeding, and so that's what happens.
Do they just do the older leaves, or do they eventually move up the cane?
They'll eventually move up. So they tend to start low, and the reason for that is that they start off their yearly cycle on ground cover plants. So they're on weeds, a lot of our broadleaf weeds, things like field bindweed, common mallow. They're very common on those. And so weeds in your raspberry patch or other crops that you're having problems with mites can be part of the problem. So getting rid of the weeds.
So he's got no weeds. I mean, he's so, but, very meticulous about
okay.
this.
But there are weeds around. I mean,
but yes, within a distance. So I just wondered how well mites travel.
So they will blow on wind currents.
Okay.
So they're not good at, they don't have wings, and they won't walk long distances, especially across like hot soil, bare soil kind of thing. So it's mostly the first ones are going to blow in on some wind currents.
They're like little tiny spiders.
Yes.
They use
a same kind of mechanism where they put down a little bit of webbing, and then they blow on that to kind of help direct their flow. Mm-hmm. And so they don't go too fast or go too far or something like that. So ballooning, that's called. So it may be that they're ballooning into your father's raspberries, but they do like to start on those lower leaves. But they will, if populations develop and they get high enough, they will continue to move up the plant. and they do decrease the amount of productivity. They're stressing the plant, so the plant's not going to put out as many or as big or as juicy and sugary berries as he would like.
So what and when to control these?
So for the homeowner, there's really not many miticide chemicals per se on the market. But despite that, you have a great tool, and that is your hose. And with getting one of those nozzles on the end that you can adjust the spray so that you can have kind of a penetrating kind of spray, make it pretty harsh, but not so harsh that you blow the leaves off the plant.
But you have to go on the underside?
Yeah, but just take it and wash down the lower parts of the plant. You'll need, when you first start to see that russeting on the lower leaves, or if you see mites on your green beans or on your eggplant, those are two other common plants in the garden that they particularly like. Just get out your hose and wash them off, especially in the evening time is good, because what you're doing is you're physically either destroying them, the water's going to disrupt their cuticle and they'll die, or you're washing them off into the ground and they don't like water and they're just not going to ever make it back up on the plant.
Which is why they like it hot and dry.
They like it hot and dry, and do that every 2 to 3 days until you see, you're not going to get rid of the russeting that you already have, but you shouldn't see it progress. And also the leaves tend to look kind of dirty because they do have this webbing, and so dust and dirt sticks to it. And so when you wash it off, it should kind of clean the leaves. So the mites like that kind of dusty, dirty environment. And if you don't see that dustiness building back up again, that tells you that the mites are not there. The other neat trick you can do is just take a piece of white paper or whatever, shake agitate the leaves, the limbs over that. And if you see all these little dots that drop down to the paper and start to crawl around, those are the mites. You know they're still there. And so do it until you don't see that happening.
So they're like aphids. Once you knock them off, they don't crawl back up?
I mean, some can, but if they're, the young ones and you've kind of, drowned them almost, they're probably just not going to recover from that.
Okay.
But there's always some eggs there, and if you don't get all the eggs off, those will hatch and you'll get some more. So just keep an eye on it during the hot, dry weather, and you can just spray them down whenever you need to.
Anything else that would be of particular interest at this time of year?
So we were talking just before the show about the greater peach tree borer. Now, this is the moth that has a caterpillar, a larva, that bores right in the base of peach, apricot in particular. Those are our most sensitive ones. Occasionally, I've seen it in a sweet cherry, but I don't think it's very common. It's mostly in peach, nectarine. Nectarine is just like a peach. And apricot are the common ones that I've seen it in. And it can kill the tree if the larvae can girdle the entire cambial tissue all the way around the trunk. So it's one you want to keep out. And we don't have good ways to keep it out, unfortunately, except with an insecticide spray right to that lower section of the trunk.
You can't put a wrap or something around the trunk.
In fact, somebody looked at that, and they've actually showed that if you have a lot of vegetation, so grass or weeds growing there, or you put some kind of a wrap on the tree, that it actually, they like that better. And so it's best to have the base of the peach, nectarine, apricot trees open without much vegetation around it. And the timing is now, where the greater peach tree borer moths are out. So that means they're mating, they're laying their eggs they'll just lay it right at the trunk line of the tree. And you'll see holes with sap oozing out and sawdust-like material coming out of that hole. And that tells you that you have a greater peach tree borer. And so if you've seen that, or you have peach trees and you're concerned about that, now is the time to protect your tree.
And it's just the trunk?
It's just the very lower part, like the bottom 18 inches of the trunk.
Okay,
so you're not spraying.
Need to do the whole
trunk.
You're not
spraying up into the tree, onto the fruit. It's just a very limited area.
Because I've wondered, because in the spring, to help control other insects, we are spraying the scaffolding of the tree and not the trunk, because there are beneficial insects on the trunk.
But now it's just for peach, nectarine, apricot, just those trees. We're just spraying that very lower base. It's not a lot of area that you're applying or a lot of chemical that you're applying. The chemicals for the home gardener are carbaryl, which is 7, permethrin, esfenvalerate. And again, look at our IPM advisory on tree fruits, and that will give you brand names of some of the products that are registered that you can use.
What about the pheromone traps. I think we've discussed this before, but in my mind, I think I'm remembering you've got to have enough
trees
for them to be effective. So if you're seeing them in a catalog and you've only got a couple of trees, don't buy them because they're not going to work.
Right. So there's a couple different ways pheromones are used. So pheromones are the insects that the chemicals that insects use to communicate. In this case, we're talking about sex pheromones. Those that usually the female gives off to call the male. And so there's a couple ways you can use them. You can use them in a trap, and a trap is used for monitoring to tell us when the insect is active and give us a general idea of how many. But they are not a control tool. You're only catching males. You don't catch enough to lower the population to make it worth it. So when you see traps sold in catalogs as control for control, that won't work. The other way they're used quite effectively in commercial production is mating disruption. And these are different kinds of dispensers, devices that release the pheromone gradually over a period of time. And those will work in larger orchard blocks, but they're not going to work for just a few trees in the home garden because you have to have enough area that has this pheromone being dispersed from to really disrupt the mating behavior to keep the males from finding the females.
In our next Bug Bites section, where we look at a bite of information from the world of insects, another one that popped out at me was pyrethroid insecticides and how they've affected bees. And this one says that it alters honeybee behavior. How is it doing that?
So we have generally, when we think about insecticide effects on bees, we've been most concerned about what we call toxic effects. So if you spray a certain rate out there and the honeybee coming to the flower picks up a toxic or a lethal dose, it dies. So that's certainly one concern. But we now, with the colony collapse disorder, this really opened up our eyes to we always knew this, but how important it could be, all these what we call sublethal effects. So effects that aren't killing the bee in this case, but are altering its behavior in some way. And so that's become a big area where people have been investing a lot of research recently, is looking at all different kinds of insecticides, looking at what we would call sublethal doses. So these are lower rates. So we know when we spray a crop or spray a plant, and we do it when there's not bees present. But what happens if the bee comes several days later, but there's still some residue on there, and it still gets contact with that? What's happening? And so we're learning now that there are a lot of sublethal effects and that it does affect bee behavior. This work was done with honeybees, but certainly there's many kinds of bees, and we could probably speculate that there'd be similar effects on our native bees too. And so what they found is that they spend less time being social. So for a honeybee, that's not a good thing because they are a social insect. And so they don't communicate as well with their sisters in the hive. They are not as efficient in their foraging. If they're a worker foraging bee, they'll still forage, but they're just not as efficient. They don't bring back as much pollen and nectar. When they get to the hive, they don't communicate as well with her coworkers about where the good foraging sites are. Or if they're assigned to then do something in the hive, they may not do that as effectively. And so they are seeing just kind of like diminished, quality and effectiveness to their life's work when they've been exposed to certain insecticides. And then the one group of insecticides that we've talked about quite a bit and has been in the news is what we call the neonicotinoids. So this is the one like imidacloprid that has been a popular systemic insecticide that people have used in the landscape and even the garden to some extent. But this group of insecticides they're talking about in this article are pyrethroids. And these are very common insecticides. Mm-hmm. In fact, we use them on our pets to keep off ticks and fleas. We even use them on ourselves for head lice shampoos. We use them to treat our homes for bed bugs and cockroaches and other kinds of indoor pests. And this group of insecticides called pyrethroids has really had a big resurgence in use following some of the cancellation of some of the what we called our more toxic broad spectrum kinds of insecticides like diazinon, glutathione, and some of those that we had used in agriculture now are no longer allowed because of their more broad spectrum negative effects on beneficial insects and bees. But now this pyrethroid group, they're finding it's not so bad on killing bees outright, but what it's having impacts on is the sublethal behavioral changing effects.
Well, and if you happen to be a honeybee carrying around a varroa mite that's already kind of weakened.
Right.
You can see this compounding.
Exactly.
And where colony collapse disorder can eventually come from.
Right. And that's a really good point. It's usually it's not just one thing that's contributing colony collapse disorder. It's multiple factors. And so now there's some really strong evidence that pyrethroids, and I'm sure other insecticides as well, even when they're, you know, at lower doses, not killing the bees, but they are contributing to their overall decline in numbers and reproduction.
And I know humans aren't bees, but it also begs the question, so how could this be affecting humans? Diane, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Great information. It's the Zesty Garden, and Diane Alston, who is USU's Extension Entomologist, has been my guest. You're listening to the Zesty Garden, and it's our Going Native segment. Jeanette Warner, owner of Wildland Nursery just south of Richfield in Joseph, is my guest, and we're going to talk about ephedra. Sounds like a drug.
Oh, it is. It is ephedrine. That's where ephedra comes from.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is also known as green tea or Mormon tea or Brigham tea.
For some reason, the pioneers came west and they thought that they could claim that name, put their name on it. The Indians have used it forever for medicinal uses.
Okay.
Makes you feel good.
And it's evergreen?
It is evergreen. It's an amazingly different plant to have in a yard.
How is it different from other plants?
Because it's evergreen and the needles are long and slender like a broom. And it looks almost like a broom. If you know what a broom plant looks like, that's what it looks like. But it isn't invasive. It's very tidy, has a beautiful shape. It's very arching, and the needles just arch and kind of fall over. Beautiful against a rock wall or just in a shrub border. And because it's green year-round, you have this really interesting thing growing out in your garden in the wintertime.
And it's fragrant yellow flowers in the spring. I must
yes.
admit, I've never seen flowers on them before.
Oh, yes, yes. Where I am, where I live, the hillsides are covered with them. And a certain time in the early spring, you drive up that canyon, and it's yellow, great big yellow bushes from this.
And it's a gymnosperm, so why don't you talk about what that is?
A gymnosperm is like an evergreen, and they produce cones. And so the flowers, you know, look like a regular, ordinary yellow flower, a small, tiny flower, but then it produces these little tiny cones that are about a quarter of an inch long with two seeds in it. Each little cone has two seeds in it.
But it's not invasive by any means.
Oh,
it's
no.
very slow growing.
No, it grows pretty fast. I mean, it grows nicely. It doesn't grow
okay.
really fast, or else you're not sitting there waiting, you know, forever for it to grow.
And average well-drained soil or dry clay?
Dry clay, yeah. Mine is in dry clay, and like everything else, gets watered once every 2 to 3 weeks, if I remember. And
if you don't remember, is this the kind of plant that will do fine?
Yep.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
so
very
it's
nice.
It's medium to low water,
mm-hmm.
Full sun to part shade.
Right.
Provides cover for ground-feeding songbirds.
Right. Well, actually, every plant can do that. Every plant has some purpose that way. The seeds for the birds, the pollen for the butterflies or the bees, or just plain cover.
And this one's fairly zone hardy, 3 to 6, zones
right.
3 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
Plant in any shrub border rarely needs pruning.
Right.
I love a plant that I don't have
yeah.
to worry about.
It's like you look at it, okay, what shall I do? Now and then you might get a broken branch, but I don't think I've touched mine in 10 years.
And yours is how tall now?
About 3 feet.
Oh,
3 feet
okay.
by 3 feet.
So
yeah.
it's not too tall. It says used with pinyon pine, Rocky Mountain juniper, oak leaf sumac, and looks really cool with sacred datura or Pentzmann barbatus.
The Rocky Mountain juniper, the oak leaf sumac, that's its native habitat, the same mm. plants that grow in that habitat. And so you plant those in your garden, it makes a really nice contrast. The big green leaves of the sumac compared to that long, skinny leaf of the Mormon tea. Just really interesting. Yeah.
And I love that it replaces Mugo pine.
Oh, yes.
Everybody wants to grow a Mugo pine. Why do you want to do that?
And that's the same thing. It's the same thing across the U.S. They have that same Mugo pine everywhere, everybody. And this is just so much more interesting and elegant. It is so elegant when Mugo pine to me looks like a prize fighter. Say, and the Mormon tea is very elegant.
Have you made tea from it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And my son, he's such a character. When he goes hiking, he'll pick a twig and chew on it. Oh, it gives me lots of energy.
Okay, well, we've been talking about ephedra viridis,
mm-hmm.
And it's also known as green tea, Mormon tea, or Brigham tea, and it's a plant that we're recommending for your garden. And Jeanette Warner, owner of Wildland Nursery, just south of Richfield and Joseph, has been my guest. Thanks,
Jeanette. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. Regular listeners to the Zesty Garden may recall that some time ago, Brian had an interview with Brent Black in which they discussed the fact that the apples we enjoy all come from grafting desirable fruit onto strong rootstock. I hadn't known that the same thing is true of citrus fruit. From a book I've sampled before on Petals and Prose, Ruth Kassinger's A Garden of Marvels, comes more on the topic of grafting. From The Garden of Marvels, we read, most commercial citrus trees are not grown from seed. Plant a seed you've found in a tangerine, for example, and if the little sapling doesn't first succumb to bacteria, viruses, nematodes, or fungi, you will have to wait years for it to grow large enough to fruit. Even when your tree reaches maturity, its tangerines will probably be sparse on the boughs and smaller than what you can find at the grocery store. Instead of planting seeds, commercial growers buy grafted saplings either to start a new grove or to fill an existing one where individuals have died. Grafting trees are made of hardy rootstock species, often a sour orange, onto which is grafted a more commercially desirable variety, like a Satsuma or a blood orange. The rootstock imparts vigor, disease resistance, or cold tolerance, or a combination of those qualities to the fruit-bearing branches. The rootstock can also improve the yield of the scion or intensify the flavor of its fruit. Of course, seedless citrus varieties must be grafted to reproduce at all. Ruth wanted a citrus cocktail tree. One tree with oranges, tangerines, lemons, limes, grapefruit, and more. I had seen such a marvel growing on the dirt floor of an old greenhouse at Logie's Greenhouses in Danielson, Connecticut, when I was interviewing the owner for my previous book. It was magnificent, its leafy limbs brushing the glass roof and stippled with oranges, tangerines, lemons, limes, grapefruits, and kumquats, as well as hybrids like sunquats and limequats. It seemed the kind of tree that would harbor a grinning Cheshire cat or shade the blue caterpillar smoking a hookah. Possibly it was magical. Eat one of the fruits and you can live happily ever after. Well, I wanted one. It took Ruth a long time before she finally found a grower who had the magic and the experience to create such a tree. Charles Farmer, owner of a citrus nursery in the small town of Auburndale, Florida. Ruth wanted a tree large enough to soon produce fruit at her Maryland home. Was there any way I could get a bigger tree? Sure thing, he said, if you're willing to come down here and cart it back home. I got a nice 6-foot Hamlin orange in a 35-gallon pot that I can do for you. It'd be ready next spring. Is that fast enough for you? Actually, it was not. That was 15 months away. I imagine Charles attaching slender branches to the thick trunk of the Hamlin the way a surgeon might reattach amputated fingers onto a hand. I pictured a heavy wrapping of bandages around the juncture of the old and new wood and fleetingly wondered whether he used wires to hold a branch in place while the new joint healed. Surely the tissues would knit together and wounds would close in a matter of weeks. or at the most a couple of months, as they did in human skin. Shouldn't it seem to me take more than a year for a connection to form? Why was it, I asked tentatively, that I couldn't get it started sooner? Charles began to explain, but I didn't understand what he was saying. Then suddenly, I got it. My analogy was wrong. He would be grafting buds, not branches, onto a Hamlin. Grafted buds take in a couple of weeks, but they need a year or more in Florida's climate to develop from bud to branch, and the best season for grafting is in spring, when the trees are actively growing and sap is flowing, hence the 15 months. The only question was what varieties I wanted on my tree. I wasn't particular, I said, as long as I got a range of fruit colors. I didn't plan on eating my crop. I can buy fruit at the grocery store. I just wanted to look at it. He chuckled and said, okay. I have no doubt that no one had ever asked him to graft a tree for its aesthetic appeal. Then disaster struck. Ruth learned that there were restrictions on taking citrus trees out of Florida. To control a bacterial disease from spreading, the USDA has rigid limitations with fines from $500 to $10,000 for violation. While trying to get special permission for Ruth, he and Susan would take care of my tree in the meantime. Since I regularly fly to Florida to visit my mother, who lives 2 hours to the south in Fort Myers, I asked if I could drive up and watch him graft my tree the next time I was in the state. And so it is that I am in this greenhouse, sweating like a sprinkler system, and shaking hands with Charles and Susan. Both look to be about 50 and are lean and deeply tanned. Charles has a square jaw and prominent cheekbones, thanks, I learned, to his Osage Indian heritage. As we introduce ourselves, Susan announces that she's going to get budstocks from the refrigerator in the office, and I follow Charles, who is heading to the far end of the greenhouse. I hustle, dripping, to keep up. Our destination is a row of lush and leafy 6 and 7 foot trees in black plastic tubs. Charles explains, "Look in here," he says, pulling down a branch of Hamlin and pointing into the angle. The armpit, you might say, between a branch and a leaf stem. "See that?" he asks. I see a pointed bump. "That's an auxiliary leaf bud, or what we call the eye. The tree doesn't need an eye to grow now, so it's dormant. It has the potential, though, to become a new branch. The bud sticks also have eyes, and what we're going to do is take eyes off them, use a chip to graft, and put them into the branches of the Hamlin." I won't go into the actual process of grafting, but rather we'll come to the point of success. So he finds out that he can't, even when the tree has been grafted and is ready to go as a cocktail tree, he finds out he can't take it out of Florida. So he comes up with a plan that his 84-year-old mother might be willing to take care of the tree until perhaps one day Florida changes its law. His mother was a character herself and probably wouldn't have done it if it was just an ordinary tree. But the uniqueness of the tree appealed to his mother, and she says, yes, she will take care of it. The watering of it, however, would be a challenge. And finally, his 13-year-old daughter finds out that there is a device called a botanicals box that will track the water needs of the tree. And so he sends for it. It's called a botanicals box. He opens the box and finds a green circuit board in the shape of a saucy ovoid leaf, 2 slender metal probes for detecting moisture, and a plastic bag with several dozen transistors, resistors, and LEDs. I had no hope of putting the thing together myself, but I'm not without resources. These resources are my cousin Danny, who has a doctorate in computer science, and his clever 13-year-old daughter Rosie. Danny and Rosie agree to solder the components to complete the circuit board. A week later, they brought the assembled device. I slipped the probes, now attached to the assembled circuit board and into the soil of a parched peace lily, and plugged the cord into the wall socket and the cable into a wireless router. A minute later, the plant sent a message to my cell phone. It arrived on my Twitter account. "Urgent, water me," it read. I poured in a cup of water. "Thank you for watering me," it responded. Over the next weeks, the peace lily sent me regular updates on the moisture contents of the soil. Current moisture, 84%. Current moisture, 72%. Current moisture, 24%. Need water. I add a cup of water, but this time received, "You didn't water me enough." The botanicals turned out to be a terrific nag. The only way to make it stop was to water. I loved it. Danny taught me how to reprogram the device's script. The possibilities were endless. On my next trip to Florida, I drove to Auburndale to meet Charles and pick up my tree. I was pleased to see it now looked full and vibrantly healthy, as all the other Hamlins in the greenhouse. Each scaffold limb of my tree had a white plastic tag with its species name, and I could see that the shape of the leaves varied from branch to branch. The foliage of a variegated Eureka lemon had lovely cream-colored edges, like a ribbon around a hemline. Charles hefted the tree into my car and gave me last bits of advice and good wishes. I drove her 2 hours south to Fort Myers. I say her because I had decided my tree would be christened Dorothy, like Dorothy Parker, a woman who, like my mother, appreciated a stiff drink and might have gotten a kick out of a cocktail tree. With the help of a neighbor, I settled Dorothy onto my mother's screen porch, plugged in the botanicals, set up a Twitter account for my mother, and signed her up to receive Dorothy's tweets. The tree thrived. This is the success of a cocktail tree. If you want to read the method, I suggest you locate the book A Garden of Marvels by Ruth Kassinger. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.